south wolf went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will continue reading H. Allen Day's book, Cowboy Up, Life Lessons from the Lazy Bee. And this was published by Morgan James in 2018 in New York City. I remind you that our stories are sometimes edited for recording purposes. Our story is entitled Twister and the Prickly Pear. Twister caught my eye when he was quite young. A combination of red, blue, and dun roan, he was a handsome horse with a nicely shaped head and a pleasant attitude. One of the Lazy Bee cowboys named him Twister. At the time, I didn't know why. When we went to break him, Twister proved to be gentle and displayed an eagerness to work cattle, so I chose him for my string. The problem was that I didn't have the time to train him to be the extraordinary cutting horse I thought he could be. I did, however, know a trainer who could possibly put a shine on Twister's emerging ability. Terry agreed to help, so I loaded Twister in the trailer and dropped him off for some advanced schooling with his new teacher. About 4 months later, Terry called. "I think it's time for you to come get your horse," she said. When I arrived, she gave me the full report. "He's a good solid horse, a fine ride, and he sure does act like he wants to cut cattle. But Al, I don't think he has that innate sense of knowing when to move to make the cut. I've tried again and again to get him in the right place. If I didn't deliberately spur him and point him at the exact cow to be cut, it wasn't going to happen. A good cutting horse knows exactly where to go and when to move without being told. Twister couldn't figure out those two essentials. So much for calling this one right." "It doesn't mean he's a failure," said Terry. "You know as well as I do, he'll make a fine ranch horse." I petted Twister's nose and told him it was okay. He'd given it a good try. He hung his head a little sheepishly, but gave me a quick nuzzle. I decided he could stay in my string. I'd start him off with easy days and figure out what he could and couldn't handle. I chose to ride Twister the day Miles Brown visited Lazy Bee. Miles, the Bureau of Land Management range conservationist for our ranch, had a college degree but lacked hands-on experience. I had taken it upon myself during the past months to let Miles see some things and have some experiences he might not otherwise have had. I suggested we load our horses in the trailer and drive the hour out to Horseshoe Mountain. I wanted to check the grass and natural water catchment on top of one of the mesas. If the recent monsoon had filled the catchment with sufficient water, I would drive 30 head of heifers up there for the winter. Twister was still young, no more than 4 years old, but since Terry had ridden him quite a little, he could probably handle the trek up the 2,000-foot rise. We arrived at our destination and saddled up. I took the lead along the narrow trail hugging the side of the mountain. Autumn was just beginning to make itself known, and the day wanted to be enjoyed, so we assumed an easy pace. The mountain wall rose steeply above us on the left and fell off just as steeply on the right. It looked to be about 150 feet down to the Rocky Canyon floor. About halfway up, Twister decided to take a breather, not unusual for a horse, especially a young one climbing a steep grade. He stopped, and I let him catch his breath. Then, out of the blue, he did a maneuver I had never seen a horse do. He began backing down the trail. I lightly spurred him. Instead of stepping forward, Twister's legs began to collapse, and he started to sink. "Uh-oh," I thought. "Something's gone wrong. Best I get off this downward-moving elevator." Just as I started to swing out of the saddle on the uphill side of the trail, Twister started to tilt toward the downhill side. Before I had time to dismount, Twister fell over, taking me with him. The next thing I knew, I was 15 feet downhill, still partially in the saddle, and beginning to roll. Less than a second later, I was spread-eagled right in the middle of a very large prickly pear cactus. Before I could even say ouch, Twister rolled over me, his 900 pounds smashing my entire backside into the spiny cactus pad. This was not a sensation I wanted to be schooled in. I heard him tumble away, then all went quiet.
"Al, holy Jesus, are you hurt?"
I looked up at Miles looking down at me.
"Hell yes, I'm hurt," I said. "I'm just not sure in how many ways."
I could feel cactus spines through my jeans. Miles edged down the mountainside and extended a hand. The little needles in my palm reminded me I should have been wearing gloves. I moved my legs and arms. My hips and pelvis, previously injured in an airplane wreck, already hurt, but they seemed intact. I was half afraid to look for Twister. Fortunately, he was standing upright in the canyon, saddle in place. I took a step. Every muscle felt like it had tiny pins in it. Miles went another 10 feet down and retrieved my hat.
"What do we do now?"
he said, handing it to me. I settled it on my head to the tune of 1,000 needles moving inside me.
"Gotta gather my wits about me for a moment. This is a hell of a wreck."
Miles started pulling clumps of cactus off me. After 10 minutes, at my suggestion, he picked his way down to the bottom of the canyon to collect Twister. The canyon was studded with such huge boulders that they had to find an alternative trail. Meanwhile, I went uphill to fetch Miles' horse. No way could a human pincushion sit in a saddle. We limped our way the mile back down the mountain. Each step seemed to take 10 minutes. After what felt like forever, we made it to the truck. Miles and Twister were waiting for us. Miles loaded the horses in the trailer and helped me into the back of the pickup, where I stood during the return ride to headquarters. My wife spent over 2 hours plucking out spines that she could see, and a little less time chewing on me for getting in such a predicament. Such predicaments weren't anything new, and she gave up after a while and plucked in silence. The tiniest of thorns finally worked themselves out after 6 weeks. It was a grin and bear it time for riding horses and for moving in general. Twister never became my favorite horse, and I'm sure I never became his favorite rider. Maybe he had tried to tell me something as we walked up that mountain, and I failed to hear him. If so, I sure wish he had spoken a little louder. As it was, it took 1,000 prickers to get my attention. Some lessons in life are just more painful than others. Best to learn those quickly and not have to repeat the course. And that was Twister and the Prickly Pear. Now we'll read about another horse. This is Candy. I'd been managing Lazy Bee full-time for about 8 years, and had just lost a horse for my string, so I needed a replacement. I spent some time observing our crop of young horses, and chose a good-looking filly whose mama I had ridden years before. She'd been a nice horse, very solid and good to ride. Like her mother, this filly was blonde, with broad shoulders, a large frame, and an amiable disposition, all traits of a good horse. I decided to name her Candy, after one of our family's friends, whose sunny disposition and pretty face always made me smile. Our longtime cowboy, Claude Tippetts, heard me calling the newest horse in our remuda Candy. He said,
"Alan, that's a really bad name for that horse."
"What makes you say that?" I said. "Didn't know a bad name made a bad horse."
"It's too pretty a name. That filly can't carry a name like that and carry you at the same time. She'll die."
Maybe Claude was losing it. Next he'd be telling me to keep salt in my chaps to throw over my shoulder. I shrugged.
"Well, we'll see about that."
"Nope, she won't live. You named her wrong," he insisted.
She should be called Squaw Piss.
If I'd seen a crystal ball sitting on the corral post, maybe I would have changed her name, even to Squaw Piss, but I didn't, so she remained Candy, and Candy remained sweet, with one exception. When I went to fetch her in the horse pasture, she'd nuzzle me and enjoy being petted. She remained cheerful while being saddled, but as soon as I'd get on her, she'd put her head down and go to bucking. She couldn't buck very hard, so she never bucked me off, but when the cycle started, I had a hard time getting her to stop. I figured she was one of those young horses that had to go through the bucking phase. Eventually, I just ride her out of it, so I kept riding her in an effort to do that. She still hadn't ditched her habit the day I saddled her for a pleasure ride. The summer rains had spit-shined the ranch and persuaded grass to grow, especially in the big floodwater draw that ran past headquarters in the east pasture. An inviting blanket of green covered its normally dry dirt bottom. About a mile and a half down, the draw spread out into a big hole, maybe 100 yards long and 50 yards wide, which remained bone dry until the summer rains filled it. Then it turned into a 12-foot-deep water hole. I thought we'd go check it out, then ride through the pasture. We hadn't even left the corral when Candy went to bucking. When I got on her, she bucked. When we went out the gates, she bucked. When we rode through the draw, she bucked. Each time, she'd buck a few jumps, and I'd get her pulled up and scold her either verbally or with a little bit of corporal punishment, a spur, a slap of the reins, enough to let her know she was misbehaving. This went on and on as we progressed down the draw. I thought she'd get her head up and start paying attention to the work we were doing, which was nothing more than me riding her, trying to enjoy the scenery. But nope, she had to buck. By the time we arrived at the water hole, we were both hot and downright irritated with each other. The water line had edged up as far as it could go without spilling onto the land. The calm water invited us to cool our tempers and wash the sweat off. I decided we would go for a swim. Since a horse can't buck in water, at least that nonsense would end for a bit. I rode Candy to the edge of the water, but she refused to put her feet in. I spurred her. She turned left. I turned her back and spurred her again. She turned right. That darn horse was doing everything possible to avoid the water. This was ridiculous. I grabbed my get-down rope with its big cotton knot at the end, swung it with one hand, and popped her a good one on the hip. I should have named her Pegasus because Candy just about sprouted wings. She leapt into the air and plunged into the middle of the water. I slid off the saddle, still holding the reins, prepared to do what cowboys do when you swim with a horse. With one hand, you either hold the saddle horn or the tail, and let the horse pull you around, kind of a western version of swimming with a dolphin, though I wouldn't exactly call 20-pound chaps and a pair of pointed leather boots a version of a wetsuit. I didn't get a chance to grab the saddle horn or Candy's tail. Her back end sank, her front legs began to flail, and her head thrashed. She couldn't swim. I'd never seen a horse that couldn't swim. I tightened my grip on the reins and tried to keep her head above water. One leg came down on my head and knocked me underwater. I kicked back up. A hoof hit my shoulder hard. Another glanced my ear. I dodged another hit, still trying to hold her head up. Water was getting in her nose, and she was snorting and rolling her body back and forth and trying to climb all over me. I went under again. This time with a mouthful of water. I came up gasping for air. The water roiled around us. Candy pawed harder, desperate to find solid ground. She was starting to push me around and under. I couldn't hold her up anymore. I could barely hold myself up. I let go of the reins. By the time my boots hit bottom, the muddy water had swallowed Candy. No burping bubbles marred its dark surface. I crawled up onto dry land, my chest heaving with exhaustion. What felt like a 20-minute struggle surely had been no more than 5 minutes. Hell, maybe 3 minutes. I was numb to the bruises I sustained, numb to the glory that had been in the day. Disaster had struck with the fury of a cyclone, a tidal wave, a horse that couldn't swim. How could a horse not swim? They were like dogs. Every dog can swim. Candy had tried to tell me that she couldn't swim, but in my frustration and need to win the battle, I had failed to listen. I was not numb to the feeling of being a fool and to having my heart broken by my own stubbornness. I sloshed the 1.5 miles back to headquarters in a flabbergasted fog. I could still see our trail through the grass. I had been out for a ride on a young, healthy, pretty horse, and now she was dead. I stumbled my way over uneven ground, wet chaps swishing, boots sloshing, talking out loud, trying to figure out the whole situation. If I'd have named her Squaw Piss, would she have died? Probably, but I couldn't say for sure. All I knew was that I had failed her, and here I was doing the cowboy walk of shame back to the ranch, my horse on the bottom of a stinking waterhole. I was an idiot. I lost a horse and a friend. What kind of a cowboy was I? That day I was a jumble of recriminations, guilt, anger, regret. I was not in a place to learn. But in the following weeks and months, I looked hard at my role in Candy's death and acknowledged that I had failed my horse by not paying attention. I vowed from that point on to listen and to be receptive to what my horses were telling me. And that was Candy. And now a little change of pace with The Voice of Authority. When I started working on Lazy Bee after college, I quickly learned that my dad expected me to step up to the manager level. What I didn't anticipate was his reluctance to give me 1 ounce of his authority or power. Anything new I tried to do on the ranch, he severely criticized. He was what we now call a control freak. He disapproved of all newer grazing systems and modern equipment. He made do with pump engines installed in 1915. He was especially proud of his nice herd of Hereford cows and would show them off to anyone visiting the ranch. The Herefords were pretty cattle, imported to the U.S. from Great Britain before the turn of the century. They thrived in the lush English pastures, but when they arrived in the harsh southwestern desert, they were not happy inhabitants. The light pigment around their eyes made them subject to eye cancer, which many of them contracted, and their shorter legs and thinner hooves were not compatible with Arizona's hot, sandy soil. As a hands-on manager intent on bringing fresh ideas to the ranch, I suggested we buy some different breeds of cattle and try them in the desert. My father strenuously objected. When I said we only would buy 2 Charolais and 2 Brahman bulls, he realized the resulting crossbred calves wouldn't overwhelm his Herefords, so he went to grumbling instead of squawking. The crossbreeding experiment resulted in heavier calves, but we ended up having problems with some of the bulls. I changed tactics. I recently had been introduced to cattle specifically bred for the Arizona desert called Barzona, a solid red, long-legged, hardy breed. When I brought the first group of Barzona to the ranch, Da said, "You're going the wrong way. Everybody knows the best cattle are Hereford." After several years, it was evident the calves and mothers thrived in the desert. When I started buying more Barzona bulls to breed with our Hereford cows, my father's objections grew stronger and more frequent. It was tough pushing ahead against his wishes. "The Herefords are better mothers," he'd say. "They get more milk. The calves will sell better in the market, being pure Hereford. You know my Herefords are better cattle." I could show him that Barzona calves outweighed the Hereford calves by more than 100 pounds at weaning time.
I could show him that Barzona cows would breed annually at a rate of 92%, while the Herefords bred at 75%. The Hereford cow was worn out and ready for slaughter by age 10, and many times by age 9. The Barzonas lasted until 12 or 13 years, and were productive the entire time. Yet Da would end every one of our arguments with, "You know my Herefords are better cattle." His opposition became so fierce that he started writing letters to Sandra and Anne. "Allen is driving us to bankruptcy with those damn cattle," he wrote more than once. Sandra finally called. "Allen, are we really facing bankruptcy?" I said, "Sandra, let me have enough rope to hang myself. If I'm truly doing bad, it will come falling down around my ears." Sandra was loyal to Da, but she soon learned he was crying wolf because every year our profit grew. Gradually, Da recognized that his letters weren't sounding any alarms, and Sandra and Anne concluded Da was just being Da. I'd been his target throughout my life, right up there with FDR, the BLM, and the governor. The cowboys would do something wrong, and I would get criticized for it. It's twice as difficult doing something you think is right when every step is unsupported. But after years of climbing the steep mountainside, you eventually reach the top. About 10 years into breeding Barzona cattle, I decided one summer to keep a group of calves through the winter rather than selling them in the fall. It turned out to be a lovely winter, followed by a green spring, so the calves grew rapidly. These Barzona calves were particularly fat and perky. On the first day of our spring roundup, I gathered about 100 head of the calves. The cowboys and I had driven them into one of the corrals at headquarters. It was late afternoon, and I was walking across a corral to catch a horse that I needed to shoe for the following day. Out of nowhere, a voice spoke. It was loud and clear. "Show your father these cattle," it said. I'd only heard a voice like this once before. Still, it was so strange that it stopped me in my tracks. "Show your father these cattle," it said again. "I'm too busy," I said out loud. "I have to get ready for tomorrow." The voice repeated itself. "Show your father these cattle." This time, I knew to pay attention, so I quieted the inner debate. I went back to the barn, told the cowboys I had something to do, and for them to go up to the bunkhouse and have a cup of coffee. I didn't explain what it was I had to do, because I didn't want to see the look of disbelief on their faces. I then went up to the big house. My father was up and feeling good that day. He didn't get around the ranch anymore because he had emphysema, probably due to smoking too many cigarettes, and he stayed connected to his oxygen tank. But that afternoon, he had his mask off. I said, "Da, I gathered some really pretty calves today. Would you like to come see them?" He'd noticed all the dust and commotion down in the corral, but hadn't been able to see the calves. "Why, that'd be right nice," he said. I helped him into his car and drove him down to the corral. He couldn't walk very far, so I drove the car into the corral. I used it to push the herd into one corner of the corral, then shifted into park and let them walk out past the car. "Look at how big that steer is," said Da, pointing. "Look how pretty that one is. How much will that big one weigh?" When they had all filtered out of the corner, he said, "Drive 'em up into the other corner and let 'em come out again." We spent almost an hour in the corral looking at those pretty steers. On the way back to the house, he turned to me and said, "Allen, that's the finest set of steers ever raised at Lazy Bee Ranch." I was overwhelmed. He had never said one positive thing about the Barzona cattle. But here he was, not automatically defaulting to his statement about Herefords being better. I knew this was as close as he could come to apologizing for all of his rude remarks through the years.
I shared his joy in how handsome those steers were. About 7 the next morning, I was out in the middle of a pasture starting to round up another section of the ranch when I saw a pickup speeding out toward us. I knew it wasn't one of our cowboys because we were all on horseback. I went galloping toward the truck to find out what the problem was. Small problems don't detract from roundups. Only cataclysmic events do. I shoved the thought of what it might be to the back of my mind. Glenda Moore, the wife of a cowboy who worked for us, sat behind the wheel looking disheveled and pale. I knew before she spoke what had happened. "Your dad died in his sleep last night," she said. Even though a part of me expected her to say that, I was shocked. He had been so good yesterday. Though incredibly sad, as the next few days progressed, I was overwhelmed with gratitude for the hour Da and I had shared. It wasn't a coincidence that I had shown him the cattle. It was a reconciliation of decades of conflict. Without that voice speaking up, it wouldn't have happened. What if I hadn't listened? I would still be living with anger, regret, and who knows what else. But, as it was, sharing one simple moment erased a lifetime of conflict and hurt. And that was the voice of authority. Now we'll read A Case of Bad Gas. The airplane had become my second pickup. Almost every morning I flew around the ranch to check water levels in the tanks and make sure cattle weren't hung up in corners of pastures, especially if we had just moved them to fresh pasture. The plane also came in handy for the 45-minute trip to Tucson to attend University of Arizona basketball games. It was January, and the Wildcats were having a good season. My wife Barbara and 14-year-old daughter Marina and I had tickets for a weekend game. I went to the hangar to fuel the plane. The day before, I'd received a 1,200-gallon delivery from Chevron distributor Rex Kipp, one of my best friends. As fuel glugged into the plane's tank, something seemed off. Usually, fuel looks greenish, but this fuel had a different tint than normal. I dribbled some on the wing and watched to see if it beaded up with water, but it didn't. I drained each of the plane's fuel tanks and carburetor 3 times, thinking that if there were impurities, they would show up. Whatever drained didn't alarm me. After doing the protocol checks, all appeared normal. Still, something just didn't seem right. The three of us boarded, with Barbara in front and Marina in the back. We strapped in, and I taxied to the end of the runway. It was mid-afternoon with a light breeze and the sun still bright in the sky. I went through the takeoff checklist, checked the mags, the prop, everything I typically did, and everything seemed normal. I gave the bird power, went into a standard takeoff roll, lifted off, and started to climb. We'd reached about 60 feet when the motor quit. It went completely dead, as if I had turned it off. My mind jumped into emergency mode. Don't turn. Keep the nose down. Land straight ahead. We dropped down past the runway just where a series of gullies 2 or 3 feet deep crossed my line of sight. We hit those gullies, and that's the last thing I remember. When I came to, I was hanging upside down in my seat with blood pooled below me. I popped loose from the seatbelt, dropped down to the ceiling, kicked open the door, and crawled out. I could smell fuel. I suspected it was leaking and was worried the plane would catch on fire. My hips and legs screamed with pain. I couldn't walk, but I managed to crawl back inside the plane and unbuckle Barbara, who was unconscious, and crawl with her outside past the end of the wing. I crawled back, unbuckled Marina, and started to drag her out. She was coming too and helped me some. She was dazed and wasn't sure where she was, but once out of the plane, she stood up and walked. "Marina," I said, "we crashed the plane. We need help." She looked at me like she had no idea who I was. I said, "Walk back down the runway. Get in the car.
drive to the house. It was about a mile away. Marina was so dazed that I had to repeat the instructions several times before she left. Shortly after, Barbara came too and was able to walk over to me. She kept talking to me, trying to keep me from passing out. Finally, my parents, Marina, and three cowboys pulled up in a car. I later learned that I had a deep gash across my forehead. My skull showed, and part of my face drooped. Victor Sanchez took one look at me and said, "He's going to die, and I'm not going to stay here and watch it happen." So he left. I heard him through my pain, and my inward reaction was, "You little coyote, I'll pull through this, and when I do, I'll kick your ass." Then I had an out-of-body experience. I was 10 feet above and looking down at people milling around me. While I was there, it came to me that if I wanted to survive, I needed to take charge. Somehow, I landed back at ground level. I told one of the cowboys to call an ambulance. I knew it would take 90 minutes to arrive. I also knew I was breathing blood into my lungs because I could hear it bubble in my breathing. I was worried that I might choke to death. I told the other cowboy to get a blanket and load me in my parents' car and drive me to meet the ambulance. Away we went. Between the ranch and Duncan, we met the ambulance. The EMTs transferred me and hightailed it to Safford. When I was loaded, I asked one of them if he had oxygen. "Yes," he said. "Well, get prepared to use it, because I feel like I'm going to pass out. I'll need it." Turned out I didn't pass out. I talked and talked, forcing myself to stay conscious. At the hospital, the doctor immediately ordered x-rays. Part of my hip socket had broken off, my pelvis was cracked in 5 places, and I needed 80 stitches across my forehead. I spent the first night on some pretty heavy-duty pain meds. The next day I turned black and blue and achy. I was in traction, stretched out across the bed. The doctor said I would be in the hospital for 6 weeks. I replied, "Don't count on it." Since my hips and legs were immobile, I started doing arm exercises that morning because I wasn't just going to lie there like a lump. "How soon can I walk?" I asked the doctor next time he visited. "How are you with pain?" he asked. I told him I could stand some. Off came the traction. I walked 20 feet with a lot of sweat and effort and in excruciating pain. 2 weeks and 2 days later, I left the hospital. When I was in the hospital, a representative from the Federal Aviation Administration came out to the ranch. He determined the cause of the crash that totaled the airplane: water and mud in the gas. It was the water and mud that gave the fuel its funny color. As I taxied the plane, the water settled to the bottom of the fuel tank, where it went directly into the carburetor. Motors can't run on water and mud. They quit cold. I contacted Rex. He apologized profusely and felt just terrible. I'm sure he had a lot of insurance for such events, but I never did sue him. He was a friend, and a friend doesn't sue a friend. Years later, my attorney buddy told me I could have made a small fortune on a lawsuit. It was 6 months before I could walk without pain, and my pelvis healed in a way that my toes turned out and caused me to walk duck-footed. When I was back at the ranch and still on crutches, an old pilot friend named Dudley Pate called me from his home in Safford. "I have this lovely aeroplane," he said, "the same model you crashed, a Cessna 182. I'll want to bring it out and have you fly it." "I certainly appreciate your offer, Dudley, but I'm still healing from my last adventure." I didn't add that I wasn't sure if I would ever fly again. For certain, I was not in the mood to resume my flying career while on crutches. But Dudley was a persistent SOB and kept calling me. "I'll fly it over to the ranch," he said each time. I grudgingly gave in, drove to the hangar for the first time since the wreck, and crutched over to his plane. He got out of the plane and left the pilot's door open. "Hop in, Al," he said. I stowed my crutches in the back and did as I was told. He climbed in the passenger side. Well, we're here. Let's give it a go. I had no idea if I would freak out or have enough courage to give it the throttle. I started the engine up, taxied as I had taxied before, gave it the throttle, and took off. We actually had a really nice flight. Dudley never had to take the controls. Not once did I freeze like I half expected I would. Later, I bought that airplane from old Dudley and flew it for years. If a horse bucks you off, climb right back on. Dudley knew that's what I needed to do. I should have thanked him, but I never did. So here's a public thank you, Dudley, for having the wisdom to talk me into doing what I didn't want to do. If you hadn't, I might not ever have flown again, and I would have missed a lot of Arizona Wildcat basketball games. And that concludes A Case of Bad Gas. Now we'll read Three Horses. The horse lovers of the world like to think that all horses are wonderful. But horses are like people. They have different abilities, personalities, hang-ups, and ways of approaching life. Think of all the people you know. Some people are difficult to be around because of their attitude and actions. Some you can trust, and some you can't. Some you love, and well, some you just try to like. Often, folks come into your life, and you simply have to deal with them regardless of who they are. So it has gone with the horses in my life. Take Cheyenne. He was a pretty horse, between a bay and a sorrel, with a small head and ears, and an intelligent look in his eyes. Mixed in with all that was a mean streak. Where it came from, I've no idea, but it sure made itself known when our cowboys started to break him. That's when Cheyenne began looking for the opportunity to do damage to his rider. His methodology for hurting a rider was to first get him unbalanced, then duck out from under him. If the rider fell, Cheyenne would wheel around, try to kick him, or if the rider was in range, try to bite him. Several of my cowboys got bucked off. Although I don't recall Cheyenne actually doing damage, I grew worried that he was going to succeed in his efforts, so I decided to put him in my string. Better that the boss gets hurt by a horse than someone else. I was riding Cheyenne one day when we started rounding up in the Three Mills pasture. It was fall, and we'd left headquarters at dawn, maybe around 5 o'clock. It was completely still that morning, but boy, it was frosty cold. About a mile and a half away, the Department of Transportation was resurfacing the highway that ran along the north side of the Three Mills pasture. As the repair crews fired up the burners to heat the asphalt, a big cloud of black smoke puffed into the air. Cheyenne took one look at that black cloud, stuck his head down, and went to bucking. At least he bucked straight forward, so he was fairly easy to ride. The problem was that I was wearing gloves, and they were kind of old, slick gloves. Before I knew it, the reins began slipping through my hand. I had to reach higher and higher to keep the tension, while Cheyenne kept bucking. My hands were just about above my head when I got to the end of the reins. They slipped right through my hands, and I tumbled backward out of the saddle. Cheyenne kicked at me with both hind feet. Fortunately, his legs weren't long enough to reach me. The other cowboys had to chase him down and bring him back to me. I was embarrassed and angry that he got the best of me. A quiet little black cloud a mile and a half away was an awfully flimsy excuse for a horse to put his head down and to go to bucking. Another episode with Cheyenne happened at Big Tank, maybe a year later during fall roundup. It was a cold day, even colder than it had been over at Three Mills pasture. I had intestinal flu and was shivering, sweating, had diarrhea, and pretty much felt like crap. I should have taken the day off, but the boss can't take a day off on the roundup because the roundup will come to a dead stop. So there I was, wearing a big fleece-lined coat. I had stashed a glass bottle of K-O-Pectate in one of the pockets. We'd ridden out before dawn and were about a mile away from Big Tank. The basalt rock, from boulders to small rocks, was everywhere.
except for one spot, a circle maybe 50 yards in diameter where nature had left the dirt bare. When we got to that spot, my ears were freezing. The hood wasn't up on my fleece jacket because I was wearing my cowboy hat. I set my hat down on the saddle horn for a minute so I could pull up my hood. That was all Cheyenne needed. He put his head down and went to bucking. My reflexes were as sluggish as the rest of me. On the first jump, I lost the right stirrup. I thought, well, he's got me. So I started looking for a soft place to land. I hadn't even noticed that we were right in the middle of this cleared area. I thought, boy, that's lucky, because I'm about to fall off. And when I come down, I won't hit a rock, and the Kaopectate bottle won't break. By then, Cheyenne decided that he'd had enough bucking. He put his head forward and started running. I'd lost one bridle rein in this fiasco, so only had one bridle rein in my hand, but was able to regain my balance. He ran out of the rock-free area and charged off over the rocky prairie. I couldn't stop him, because I only had the one rein. But one rein at least gives you some leverage. I pulled that rein, and sure enough, Cheyenne started making a big circle back to where the cowboys were. He pulled up to a stop right in front of them. And they were laughing, which I'm sure they started when Cheyenne started bucking, and I was flopping all over the horse. I gathered myself back up, got my foot in the right stirrup, found the other rein, eventually got my hat, and on we went. I rode Cheyenne for quite some time after that. I never did like him, because I never did trust him. I was pretty certain he'd hurt me given the chance, but he was a strong horse and could get the job done as long as I kept my guard up and I didn't have the flu. Another horse that bucked a lot, though for different reasons, was a mare we raised at the ranch named Idiot. I don't remember her mother or the cowboy who bequeathed her that name. Idiot was nervous all her life. When she was just a filly and we were teaching her to lead and load in the trailer, she was goosey and jumpy and hard to deal with. When you got your hand on her and talked sweet to her, she calmed down. She loved to be rubbed and would put her head down and beg you to keep rubbing on her. If you did anything that was a new or fast movement, she jumped and whirled and tried to jerk loose and run off. Unlike Cheyenne, though, she didn't want to hurt anyone. She was just nervous. By the time she was a young mare and big enough to be broken, we had too many horses on the ranch. Dodd didn't want to increase our mare herd, so he picked 5 fillies to be spayed, and she was one. He said, go ahead and break 'em. They'll make good saddle horses. I assigned Idiot to Lonnie Moore, a young cowboy from Duncan who was working at the ranch. Lonnie took her, but was always afraid of her. I didn't blame him. She was so jumpy, Lonnie was afraid that she was going to jump out from under him. If a jackrabbit jumped out real close to her or under her feet, she jumped about 10 feet forward instead of jumping sideways away from the rabbit. When you got on her, she stood still and waited, then started off nicely until you moved your weight wrong, or your hat blew off, or you swung your arm out suddenly to point to a cow. Then she jumped like she'd seen a rabbit or a coyote, and she'd try to get away. Sometimes she ran off. If you didn't pull up on her pretty quick, she kept on going. One day we were at High Lonesome and had just started to drive some cattle toward Summit. Lonnie was riding Idiot. He dismounted to take off his jacket. Using the saddle string, he tied part of the jacket on the left side of the saddle. Before Lonnie could secure the jacket on the other side, it flopped against Idiot's right side. She jerked loose from Lonnie and ran about 4 miles before we could catch her. The only thing that frightened her was that loose jacket. Lonnie started calling her Wanda. He said, "You wonder what the hell she's gonna do next." I decided to start riding Wanda. I figured one of the cowboys would get careless and get bucked off or fall off, get their boot hung up in a stirrup and get dragged, or somehow get hurt. After my first couple of rides, I learned that I had to sit right square in the center of her back
and not wave my arms or shift my weight. Then, she acted like a really good cow horse. I also learned that she was super strong. She had muscles like iron. I could ride her on my longest days when we covered 25 miles. She was the same when I got on her first thing in the morning as she was 8 or 10 hours later. A lot of horses weaken toward the end of a long day. You hope they don't get so tired that they quit on you. But Wanda was always fresh and strong and was a real pleasure to ride all day long. She walked through the deep rocks like an athlete. She had exceptional balance and could step over larger rocks and find a spot to put her feet down between the small rocks and never slow down. She didn't mind a rope too much. She was nervous when I swung the rope, but if I roped a calf and went to drag it to the branding fire, she knew her business and would go to the fire. If the calf ever started running toward her with the rope, or especially ran behind her where the rope touched her hips or under her tail, she blew up like a stick of dynamite. I didn't want to be on her when that happened. I roped a lot of calves and dragged them to the branding fire, but boy, oh boy, was I careful not to let them have any slack or let them run up behind her. One time, I was riding her on the longest day of the roundup. The wind was blowing that day, a big old west wind blowing 30 miles an hour all day. The drive down to Old Camp went fine. When we turned east and began the trek back home, the wind was at our backs. Wanda started jumping and whirling and kicking and was just very upset with something. I couldn't figure out what it was. Several times I dismounted and examined things. I finally discovered a bunch of cockleburrs caught in her tail. When she headed east, the wind blew her tail up between her legs and the cockleburrs scratched her. She wasn't having any of that. I took out my pocket knife and cut off her tail right below the end of the bone. The bone runs down the center of the tail, then stops. Below that point, tail hairs hang down for another foot or two, so I cut her tail off at the end of the bone and didn't leave any cockleburrs. I rode Wanda for many years. We got along fine and had a good partnership. She told me what she expected from me, and I always tried to give it to her by not getting lazy with my posture or hand motions. Then I could count on her to be a mighty fine cow horse, loyal and trustworthy to the end. Another fine cow horse I had was Little Charlie Brown. I was starting to cowboy full-time when Little Charlie came along. He was the younger brother of Charlie Brown, another good cow horse. The two looked quite alike. Little Charlie was gentle, had a good gait, and loved to work cattle. When you were cutting cattle in the herd, you were happy when you were riding Little Charlie. He had two characteristics that set him apart from other horses. When Little Charlie and I rode in the drag, if a cow slowed, Little Charlie charged that cow and bit her muscle right above the back hock. He clamped down so hard that he raised that cow's leg clear off the ground. The cow would bawl and jump and try to run, but she couldn't get far with her leg firmly stuck between Little Charlie's jaws. I'm sure it hurt. If I spurred him, he held onto it for 20 or 30 yards. The cow kicked at Little Charlie with her free leg, but he held his head sideways and dodged the kicks. If I pulled back, his teeth came off the cow's muscle with a snap. That cow usually didn't drop to the back anymore because it wasn't pleasant to get her leg bitten. Driving cattle that way was fun because Little Charlie kept the herd moving. He never bit a calf, though, only nudged it. I didn't teach him to do that. Somehow, he knew not to hurt a baby. He just bumped the little guy with his nose and boosted him forward. The other thing I always loved about Little Charlie Brown was his strength. He wasn't a very big horse, but by golly, could he pull. And by that I mean he could drag about anything I roped. If I had a full-grown bull roped and needed it dragged into the next corral or somewhere, I'd dally up and Little Charlie would do his thing. He'd crouch low to the ground, tuck his head, and lurch forward. Most of the horses couldn't do that. They'd pull at that bull and pull and pull until I'd know they couldn't get the job done. I never really figured out how a horse as small as Little Charlie developed so much power. He must have had the right kind of muscles. If you were roping calves and dragging them to the fire for branding, you could rope all day long and little Charlie would never tire. Most horses tell you they're getting tired after dragging 15 or 20 calves, and it needs to be somebody else's turn, but not little Charlie. I could rope on him all day. He was one of my favorite horses because he had those fun personality traits. When he wasn't driving cattle or pulling something, he could be a little lazy. He acted like he was half asleep, but when I got my rope out, he became all horse. I always was really happy to saddle up with little Charlie, because when I did, I could trust him to give the two of us a good day. And that was three horses. And our final story is Circles of Trust. Ranch children learn how to drive at an early age. So it went with my sisters and me. Since we never drove underage on the highway, we never broke any laws. Our first driving lesson was sitting on Da's lap and steering the pickup. Ann and I loved that, but then we wanted to learn how to shift, so he taught us how to shift. He pushed in the clutch, and one of us shifted the gears. It would be some time, however, before either of us would be tall enough to work the clutch, so at ages 6 and 5, Ann and I became determined to figure out a way to drive the pickup together without Da's help. We worked out a system. I crawled on the floorboard where I was responsible for pushing the clutch, the brake, or the accelerator. Ann steered, shifted, and told me which pedals to push. At first, we were only allowed to do this when Da was in the pickup with us. After a time, he began letting us drive through open gates on our own. He got out of the pickup, opened the gate, and Ann and I drove through without him. That was the coolest, not having him in the truck. One day, we stopped at a large gate going into Big Pasture, and Da got out to open it. "Let the clutch out," Ann said. I did. We rolled through the gate. I was waiting for her to say brake, but the command never came. We weren't going fast, but we were going. I saw her look over her shoulder. "Speed up," she said. She started to giggle. I followed orders. "He's catching up. Go faster," said Ann. Now she was laughing. I was thinking that Da would soon be shooting fire from his hat. We bounced over the ground some more. Finally, Ann started circling back. When I sat up, we were in front of Da, who had his hands on his hips and his hat on the ground. He'd run about 100 yards. By then, Ann and I were doubled over and laughing so hard that he couldn't help but see the humor and join us. By the time I turned 13, I was a seasoned ranch road driver. We had about 60 miles of road on Lazy B, and I knew every mile of it. A classmate of mine owned a 34 Plymouth and wanted to get rid of it, so I bought it from him for $75. It was a classy car, a deep green, single-seater convertible with a rumble seat and spoke wheels. What 13-year-old wouldn't be in high heaven with that car? Its speed topped out at about 60 miles per hour. Da made me promise that I would never run it on the highway, and I never did. He also forbade me to use ranch gas. I talked a distributor who brought gas to the ranch into bringing a barrel for me. I paid him every time. Each barrel lasted me quite a while. When I went to college, I bought another car, one with a license, and left the Plymouth at the ranch. During the semester break, I went looking for the Plymouth, only to discover Da had sold it. He was tired of having that old car around. I was heartbroken. I'd loved it, and now it was gone. Da never gave me the money from the sale, never told me to whom he'd sold it. He pulled stunts like that every so often. But he was my father, and I felt like I needed to trust him, or work around him, and always hoped he trusted me. I had a different relationship with my mother. We implicitly trusted each other. In her later years, Ma suffered from dementia. Sandra, Ann, and I had a family meeting
where we decided that I could care for her best at the ranch, in the familiar surroundings she loved so much. I loved having Ma at the ranch. Every day, she waited for me to come in from work, then asked me the same question, "Can we go for a walk?" We set out on our walk, and for the half mile, or sometimes mile, I told her about my day. She didn't always talk about hers, but often commented on the birds and other animals we might see on the cacti and other plants. We appreciated our time together and being outdoors. One day in late summer, I walked in and she said, "Can we go for a walk?" I said, "Look at the clouds outside. I don't think it's a good idea to walk today. It looks like it's about to rain." "I think we should go ahead and walk," she countered. I let her twist my arm. We started out walking and watching the clouds. We barely were a quarter mile from the house when a cloud decided to turn loose. Big, hard raindrops fell upon us. When we started to get seriously wet, I picked up Ma like you would a child. She didn't weigh but 100 pounds. She wrapped her arms around my neck, and I went running back toward the house. I'll never forget her laughter. She was having the best time that she could imagine. We arrived completely soaked, but both giggling at our experience. It was one of the best walks I've ever taken. If she hadn't trusted me to care for her, and if neither of us had trusted that things would work out, we never would have had those special times together. And that was Circle of Trust. Thank you for joining us for Western Short Stories, as we've read from Cowboy Up, Life Lessons from Lazy Bee, by H. Allen Day. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sound of Arizona.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on On-Demand Podcast. You can also now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.